Welcome to IntelliCast, powered by Skip.
And on that note, we are going to begin our program. Good morning, good afternoon, hello. Thank you all so much for being here today. We are absolutely so excited to have this our guest, Savi Sharma, have a nice conversation with our executive director, Cam Mackey. This promises to be a pretty cool program, so I'm not going to take any more of your time. Feel free to ask questions in the chat. We will be happy to relay them, so it is being monitored. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to Cam. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Michelle. Everyone, welcome. And for those of you who don't know, I'm Cam Mackey. Great to see you. Feel free to be on video if you care to. If not, that's fine too. But more and more, we're trying to keep these things casual. So feel free to turn your video on and we won't complain if your cat crawls across the screen. So guys, as Michelle said, really excited to welcome Savi Sharma with us today. For those of you who didn't read her bio, spoiler alert, it's awesome. She's had a really great career with Nike in a variety of roles, all around, you know, strategy, growth, innovation, general management. And we were really, really excited to connect with her a couple months ago. And when she agreed to join us this afternoon to talk a little bit about some of her experiences watching and participating and helping lead Nike's crazy transformation as a company. So you know, Savi, welcome. I do have Nikes on. I wish I could show you, but I'm repping the brands. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, good morning, and good day, depending on where you're joining from. I'm super excited to be part of this discussion and looking forward to it. Cam, do you want me to give a little bit of introduction about me?
Yeah, you know, that'd be great. Yeah, we'd love to hear a little bit about your journey at Nike to maybe start us off. Thank you.
Sure. So I have had a fantastic 20-year career journey at Nike. And as Cam was alluding to, you know, I had roles in a variety of business functions. So you could say it's easier to say which business functions that I did not work in than what I worked in, because it's a long list. You know, if you think of a value chain of any company, from innovation on one side to retail on the other side, I touched most of them. And during the various roles, you know, strategy design and implementation, technology delivery leadership, innovation have been like, they stand out as almost like a three-legged stool. That's kind of has been my platform. And of course, you know, I have had other roles that I was pulled into. So at Nike, sometimes you end up doing two or three jobs when you are in one job, which probably is the same for many other folks, you know, in different companies. What has been fascinating is when I joined Nike in 2000, it was a $9 billion and less than 10,000 employee company. And when I left Nike in January this year, we are 80 plus thousand employees and 40 plus, I don't know the exact numbers, you know, the results will be coming, but that $1 billion. So it has been tremendous growth. And I have had the privilege of both being part of and growing with Nike during that time and really witness and be in those conversations every time as we have these conversations, cross-functional powwows, as they are called, you know, to think about what's our moonshot, where should we, you know, should we have an incubator on this particular concept that we really want to have it ready and come to life in the next 5 years and be part of that innovation, you know. So it is really, it has been a privilege to be part of those and to see how Nike uses that embedded dexterity from a strategy standpoint and how it has worked and how it adjusted when sometimes things didn't quite work, how it course corrected. For me, I think, you know, the roles, the way they work at Nike is that regardless of the function, the roles that I played always had the analysis of your competition as well as the analysis of your consumers, like understanding the consumer intimately. And that is the combination, that is the golden combination that you use when you are formulating the strategy, whether it is this cross-functional power where you decide we need to have an incubator, or it is the implementation that is going to go for the next 1 to 3 years. And the other side of me was that I have also been very active in employee networks of Nike and have had a wonderful opportunity to lead and be play an active role in the employee network. So that is another privilege I've had. So all overall, it has been a fabulous journey, and I'm currently interviewing and exploring to figure out my next role. But I'm so excited just to talk through what my experiences have been and what I have seen and perceived as I grew with Nike.
Well, that's a great overview. Thank you. And I first off, I'm totally going to steal that whole concept of cross-functional powwows. So thank you for that. Maybe let's start a little bit about ambidexterity. And so, as kind of a defining it, means, you can use your left hand or your right hand. And, from a strategic perspective, I think we all probably get what it is. It's, you have the core business, for example, and then you're also pursuing, something higher risk, et cetera. But maybe just talk to us a little bit about, how ambidexterity works from a strategic perspective, and what are some of the challenges and opportunities in that?
Sure. So, ambidexterity, when I think about that, I remember the Harvard Business School professor, Professor Tushman. When I went through my executive education, he teaches that with such passion. And he basically talks about it, like you said, Cam, as a creative tension between that, profit-making, revenue-generating core business unit and this opportunity, how you grab onto it to create those game-changing, trailblazing innovations, and that's kind of the creative tension. So, Nike has showcased that it can be ambidextrous by having both of them and managing both of them extremely well. Now, the way the fundamentally it works is that the core business is always busy with, profit and loss and continuing to reach to the consumers. And they have more of what you can call as an evolutionary innovation. So they have that incremental. So they are continuing to figure out, and they try to understand the consumers, but more doing the incremental fashion because they don't have either the mind space or the luxury of the money flowing to be able to make the big game-changing revolutionary stuff. Now, the some companies have just an R&D unit, some companies have R&D and incubator. And these are two different concepts. And maybe let me touch on those two, how they're different. The R&D of unit of a company is really the one that fills the pipeline into the core business. So, while the core business itself is looking at some little incremental evolutionary stuff, every 2 years, you need something that's revolutionary. Like if you have seen Nike products, you can see that Nike had electronics in the shoes. And then turn around, Nike has tried with some fitness devices. Turn around, Nike has a material that opens up when you work out. So, these revolutionary innovations. So the R&D is what pumps these revolutionary innovations into your product, lines. But the purpose is to address the needs of the consumers that are in the current portfolio, but whose needs we haven't addressed, or to create a new segment of the consumers, find a new segment of the consumers that we have not. So for example, the hands-free shoe recently, it is now, the shoes people with abilities are able to wear those shoes. So that's kind of how R&D, or at least the vision of the R&D is. Now, incubator is a completely different concept. This is like looking at a completely new market opportunity. It's like creating a new market. The new market could be in any geography globally. So I think that makes the fundamental difference. And now if you pull back from a strategy standpoint, the investment strategies, the investment thesis, how you put together, how you define success when you think about revenue generation versus R&D to fill the pipeline versus incubator for new market, the definition of success is also different. Then the way you manage states and gates, that's going to be different. And the culture and norms, those are going to be extremely different as well. Now, the one key concept is the core business always has make things work. Whereas the other two units, it's more like fail forward fast. So it's that is one simplest way of describing the cultural aspects of things.
Yeah, that's great. And we had one question in the chat. I think I just want to pick up on something you mentioned. So around that R&D function, filling the pipeline with evolutionary and revolutionary products, you talked about customer needs that Nike wasn't meeting. what role does you know, kind of competitive analysis play? So in other words, is this, are you trying to fulfill needs that Nike's not meeting or that really no one's meeting? Is this a white space, or does R&D maybe not differentiate in that way?
So it is both. I don't think R&D differentiates, but so let's take a, you know, step back. I think that's a very good question. So there is a white space, you know, business design. That's kind of, you know, what Nike call does these cross-functional powerhouse I was referring to, and to start incubators. And then there are the other needs of the consumer that Nike wasn't meeting because either the society wasn't ready or the organization wasn't ready, right? So maybe let's take an example and just kind of walk through. It's a fascinating walkthrough from Nike's standpoint. So Nike went IPO back in 1980s, and it was a purely footwear company. You know, if you read any of these Nike case studies or, you know, any of these Nike press releases, you can actually see that. So it was a purely footwear company, and you actually see in one of those that Adidas was the main competition that they were actually thinking about back at that time. Now, for over 10 years, you know, as we got into 90s, you know, apparel started becoming an important aspect of Nike's overall business. And so, you know, apparel in companies started being, you know, figuring in that competitive intelligence analysis. Now, the key difference is apparel has very low entry barrier. Like, you can start an apparel business pretty quickly, like within days, right? So the way you would look at footwear and having that market share and the, how you you know, analyze your competitors, how you look at the specialty brands versus the big brands and try to understand what, which consumers are they reaching with what products, is entirely different when you are looking at apparel, because it's a low entry barrier. So you're really looking at more what the consumer is looking for and what would surprise the consumer. Like the iPod and the iPhone surprised us by, you know, Apple did that. Now, forward that into 2000s. 2000s is a big change. Like, you know, this is where Nike started, tried out the electronics in the shoes. They also tried out the fitness devices, as I was alluding to. But then as we are closing 2000 is when we had this incubator that started for owning our own retail. Nike saw a huge opportunity. Like previously, it was partner retail. Now Nike saw this huge opportunity to own our own retail because you can own the relationship. So it is not, so that is the first time, you know, I remember very distinctly, I was tapped to come into that team when the retail program was started. And that's where, you know, we are not selling products. It is not the sales relationship. It is going to be the relationship for premium experience to consumers. So that became like it's a paradigm shift, but that was the first ever time. And we continue that. That started in 2008 when we went in, and now fast forward 13 years, we are making it continuously better. Yeah. And then, so as retail came in, the big brick and mortar stores and the small digital retailers, big digital retailers, every one of them started figuring on the competitive spectrum, right? Then once that was quite successful, then we looked at manufacturing innovation a little bit, if you recall, you know, but that was not necessarily like that's a direct competition, but we wanted to have an idea because we wanted manufacturing innovation to be our competitive advantage. Then you also saw again in the early 2010s, sustainability started becoming like consumer cares. Where is this product made? How is it made? How much did we destroy the planet? Are we respecting the people that are making it? So we created the indexes, and they became like, you know, that became our part of our analysis as we formulate our strategy, you know, and also understand what other companies are doing and are we doing better than them. It's always that, right? Every company wants to be better than every other company. Then 2015, you're suddenly seeing human data analytics. Why? Because the industry and the society is shifting towards, it is not sport, it is health, wellness, fitness, sport. And so movement becomes the important one and then becomes the sport. So that's a huge paradigm shift, you know, in terms of, and so now when you think about it, like think of any company that's in the health business, like fitness device, you know, Apple Health, Google Health, you think about it. So now all of those need to be figured as you think through. So the way I saw it is not like you remove some competitors and stuff, but you have to almost like, you know, dimensionalize. It's a multi-dimensional, multi-pronged analysis. And you look at the various competitors as it matters to, you know, the incubator that you want to start, or as it matters to the big revolutionary innovations you will have in your R&D unit, and you don't take your eyes off. So for apparel, we keep an eye on Saucony and Mizuho and other specialty brands, but we also keep an eye on Lulu and Athleta. You know, they're gaining a lot of attention. So I want to pause there and see if that kind of, you know.
Well, no, I love that because you did just a fantastic job of talking about Nike's evolution really from the customer first, right? It was, you know, leading or capitalizing on these big mega trends from a consumer perspective, and then how, you know, strategy flows back from that. I guess my question is, unless the folks in your competitive intelligence groups never sleep, and you know, only drink caffeine, I mean, that's a lot of complexity. And so as you start to, you know, think about, as you said, like kind of dimensionalize, you know, which of the products or offerings or parts of the experience have different competitors, how did Nike tame that huge amount of complexity?
Yeah, so I think this is where I was, you know, what I was telling earlier about the role. So there is, there is no like a differentiated competitive intelligence unit, like, you know, in called that way. So it becomes the responsibility of many of the strategy and delivery leaders, right? Yes, there is a global corporate, what are they called? I think corporate strategy unit, but they are, you know, a set of, you know, small set of people that are assigned to various business units, but they are bringing in one perspective. But, you know, if I was in innovation research for apparel, or when I was in the retail, you know, or even in the HR functions, right, you know, I was there for 4 years, like it is part of my responsibility to, you know, look at the technology wise, the competition, or from an employee experience side, the competition. So the people in the business units are actively looking at to understand what's happening. So now you combine the deep, you know, the people who are buried in the business unit and what they are seeing and what they are hearing from consumers, customers, and, you know, from the industry. And then the global business unit strategist is also partnering very closely. So that's where you're covering the full picture. And, you know, people are still sleeping. That's kind
of, yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So you really have the folks that own, you know, either the value stream or, you know, however, you know, Nike might characterize it. That makes a lot of sense. And again, with that journey from, I'll grossly oversimplify it, you know, stuff you put on your feet, shoes, to, you know, health and wellness data. I mean, that's huge. There probably were a lot of, you know, make, buy, you know, JV, et cetera, decisions that you had to make along the way. You know, what was Nike's approach towards that? You know, balancing what you would do between, you know, the incubation and the R&D group, and let alone acquisitions, you know, what was the vision there?
Yeah. And so what I found that Nike did, they did very well, even when they, you know, when we had a couple of, you know, things where what Nike considers as, okay, learning opportunities. So, you know, Nike, as I saw it, you know, being there in the company and even being part of some of those discussions, is there were acquisitions that Nike made when they saw, you know, opportunity to add to their product portfolio. And also that particular opportunity comes in with some very strong R&D opportunities. Then, you know, that's kind of what I call mergers and acquisitions, or particularly I would say just acquisitions focused from a product standpoint. And these, you know, they continue to have them for a while, but then we evaluate, like Nike does this evaluation very, very frequently. It's almost like every 3 years, there is this big evaluation, and which is a healthy thing for any company. And when they found that something they have acquired, something they were, you know, they have in their portfolio, when that is starting to distract from the core focus, right? Nike's mission is very clear. The core focus is very, very clear. Listen to the voice of the athlete, you know, to bring inspiration and innovation to the athlete. So, you know, and again, that's a loaded statement, but still, that is like the central tenet. So when it saw that there is a distraction, they actually went ahead and very respectfully divested things off as well. So I think there is a very concerted focus on, you know, acquisitions, but then also divestitures as needed. And then acquisitions, when we had, again, they helped with the overall reaching to the more consumers and meeting more needs of the consumers and also capturing new markets. Now there is a different area Nike also does these acquisitions, and which is really the capabilities. Many times people think that a company does, you know, from a competitive advantage standpoint, you know, a company does acquisitions only for the portfolio, but that Nike has done an amazing job of getting several small, you know, companies that add to the capabilities, like supply chain capabilities, or it is the capability about, you know, some machine learning, or it's capability about some, you know, integrations, you know, the very quick data integrations. So that is another area where we have excelled, I would say, you know, Nike has excelled. And those, you know, you bring in and they become part of your capability. And that is also a way to keep pace along with your product portfolio. Your capability has to keep pace. And that's what makes a company really ambidextrous in strategy and execution, if you will.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And that's helpful. And again, I really love coming back to this theme of ambidexterity, because, you know, we're, this information is probably out there, given Nike's a public company, but, you know, I mean, the core traditional business, you know, it's, you know, you're focused very much on probably, you know, profitability metrics, whereas on the high growth, fast business, you know, profitability is maybe not the most important thing. So we got a great question from Amrith on this notion of, you know, making decisions with information. And so we've talked a lot about, you know, consumer information and customer information to drive strategy. Given Nike's, you know, super diverse group of competition, how does Nike ensure that competitive information, so information about the outside competitive information, gets shared internally, you know, ideally to the right person at the right moment? But, you know, how does that process work?
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic question. So the way it works is, you know, like as I was telling you, when I was in various groups and the various roles, how, you know, they involve some of the competitive intelligence analysis. And then there is global bringing the competitive intelligence information. So I've been part of this decision maker group for over 15 years. I think it's the first 6 years is when I was still in the engineering manager roles. So the decision, so whenever you put a business pitch together, this is a process thing that is an, you know, I think it process drives this, that this happens, you know, that the competitive intelligence information is looked at and is considered and is, you know, is part of the, that data-driven decision-making. And again, I wouldn't say that we have, Nike has been the best at data-driven decision-making in general, but I think, you know, like as years went by, we have gotten much better. So the information is very openly shared between, you know, what the information that, for example, you know, when I was in the apparel research, I was heading up the apparel innovation research, right? So I have, you know, consumer information almost coming on a daily basis because my team of scientists are talking to consumers in focus groups or, you know, a variety of other forums. Then I also have, you know, I'm partnering with the categories continuously and they're gathering the information as well. And it is, you know, when we say it is consumer information, many times there is so much that comes that you wouldn't get, you know, when you are just kind of, you know, focused on competitive intelligence analysis. So that information I freely share with the corporate business unit. And similarly, corporate business unit also shares it back with me. So, you know, we have four gates during a year for these strategy cycle, where, you know, we look at the funding. So we don't say I got $1.5 million to implement something. I wouldn't get all the $1.5 million in the, as soon as the approval comes, I get the first quarter funding, right? So in the second quarter, you know, again, I have to go and repitch both the business case a little bit, but also the update. But when I need to repitch, there may be some competition that is coming into the landscape, which I need to be able to pitch. Because the good thing is our president of innovation is also a big on competitive intelligence analysis. So if he knows something and I don't pitch, there is no money. So that is another way of, you know, the final approvers also make sure that they're very aware of what's going on in the industry, as well as there is a strong collaboration. But we do keep this information, you know, away from the actual execution teams, not so much that they should not know, but we don't want to distract them, right? You know, if something is suddenly changed in the industry landscape and we need to course correct, they should not be distracted from the execution and we should be able to course correct at the upper level. But I think there is that free exchange of information and sitting down and, you know, working through, and even the pitch conversations are not so much like I'm going into pitch and people are all there to grill me. It is much more collaborative as well. You know, gotcha. If somebody has an additional piece of information, they collaborate as well.
So it's not like Shark Tank necessarily.
No, not Shark Tank. There is a Shark Tank process too, but we use that for taking the innovation pipeline from one stage to the other. So that's really the Shark Tank. but not at the funding and the approvals level, like the big funding and the approvals level, like the million and up.
Gotcha. Now, I want to pick up on something you said a moment ago about, you know, kind of tracking changes and, you know, something that competitive intelligence, you know, professionals are always obviously interested in is disruptions in the market. And those disruptions mm-hmm. can come from, you know, a competitor that we know about, mm-hmm. you know, doing something, whether it's an acquisition, introducing a new product, it can come from a new market entrant. But, you know, in the context of our conversation, they can also come from you know, social trends, mm-hmm. you know, from any number of regulatory changes, et cetera. So, you know, what, you know, from a competitive intelligence perspective and looking at signals, whether weak or strong, you know, what thoughts do you have on tracking those signals that can really indicate some type of major disruption, which could be a threat or opportunity?
Yeah, and I think that is so true, particularly come, you know, over the last 3 years and increasingly more as we are going, right? So social transformations was one big thing that I have seen just, you know, in the last 4 years, and I have been like have my hand in actually being part of that, leveraging those. And then the other one is the general consumer evolution, as we call it. So let's look at the social trends first, or social transformations. Right, you know, over the last 3-4 years, we have seen the Me Too, the racial injustice, and then the female marketing. You know, there are quite a few of these that has really bubbled up. And you can see, you know, in the industry, competitors of Nike and in general, every company is actually leveraging those for making things better in the society, right? So what has Nike done? And this is where I want to talk about one of them, which is what I call as female marketing. Now, you know, so when Nike saw this, you know, it's not that it is to make more money. And I think that is the difference. If a company uses a social transformation to say, I want to sell more products, so I want to make more money, versus how, you know, if there is a social transformation and there is a cause, so how can I actually go and support that cause? And there is a difference. And yes, eventually there is a product transaction and there is money, but you're not entering with that. I think that is what makes the difference. So for Nike, the way they have done is they call this female marketing, but the way we went about it is, how do we create this brand ecosystem? Combination of marketing strategies, innovation experiences, and you know, this create this ecosystem where there is this exchange of information, there's a dialogue. It's not Nike putting a lot of, you know, brand messages and videos and so forth, and it feels like you're selling to me, versus it is a two-way conversation. And as part of that ecosystem, yes, there is new, you know, we are having conversation, consumers are telling what their needs are. So there is, and sometimes we are co-designing with consumers, and you probably have seen in New York Times some of the co-design things that Nike has done, or we are co-creating with them, you know, even like developing with them and having them check on those, if the product is meeting the benefit that they're looking for from the get-go, right? And then yes, there is some level of, you know, marketing messaging, but it is integrated. It is not just about here is a product, here is a price, go sell, you know, go buy, but it is more about how we listen to them and what we did with them. And so that essentially is, it's not, it is products, but there is the experiences, and experiences is really what matters more than product, but creating that ecosystem. So the consumers feel that they're part of it. And I had first-hand experience. So when I went into the innovation function in 2016, one of the first things I did was to champion creating more innovations for females, tailored to female women's needs. And then how do we flip so that we conduct our scientific research and consumer science on women first and not men later? It's not that, you know, there is anything, you know, bigger, little about one or the other. It's more, it has been traditionally done one way. I'm like, just change it and let's see how that works out for overall, right? And, you know, we, the people that come into our lab, whether it is for focus groups, consumer science conversations or scientific research, they tell how fulfilled they feel being part of that. Even people that don't come into the lab and that are out there in the field, and we interact with them through surveys. Even, you know, we created mobile app and a kit because COVID, you can't bring anybody into the lab. So one of the, like my team and I, last March when companies were shut down, you know, we are all remote working, we responded by May. We had a mobile app and a set of, you know, products and sensors we can send, and people can do in field research by putting things on by themselves. And we hear how much, how fulfilling it is for them to be part of that, you know, creating something with a clear benefit statement. So that's kind of, you know, one of the ways how, like, you know, yes, there is the social transformation, and we want to make sure that we are focusing on the needs of women consumers. Right now, we only cater to a small part of her life. We want to expand so that we cater to a pregnant or a mother or, you know, older senior citizen or younger teen. But this is where I think we created the brand ecosystem. That's one example. Now, when you think about a consumer trend has been, and this is one of the significant one, and this is where we picked up through competition signals, and we actually had a dialogue to confirm that it is the right signal, which is, so sport has been, most people used to think only Serena Williams, LeBron James, and all these wonderful people, collegiate professional. But the demographic shift is happening in the world, not just US, in China. Like, we talk to consumers, when I say consumers, I'm not talking just US, China, Sri Lanka, Tokyo, you know, the Japan, Thailand, you know, and EMEA, like European countries. So we are intimately in connection and we have those conversations. So the demographic shift is bringing this new concept called life is sport, meaning movement as a sport. Yoga and dance are considered sports. It's not just basketball, soccer, volleyball, but pickleball is becoming like an important aspect of people being active. There's nothing wrong. And then their community-oriented sports are catching up. So again, this is a big consumer trend we started picking up starting in 2017, but come 2020, we latched on. We said, this is, you know, so there is a sport is life, which is our elite personal, wonderful. Yes, we always have innovations and experiences for them, but then life is sport, and people who are taking movement and using it to cope with a life event they have had, using it to, you know, make it part of their life, to enrich their life, using it to serve the senior citizens that they're interested in, or coach the kids that they want that are otherwise don't have a coach. So we picked up on that, and that became one of our, you know, mantra now in terms of movement and then sport, life is sport, life as sport. And then we changed our influencers. It's not only the elites, but it is also the wonderful women influencer from New York who coped with her life, or the wonderful women influencer from Tokyo who coaches kids every single day, kids between 7 and 12, so that they're active. So that is how, you know, you identify the signal, but then you go and create a nice ecosystem. I want to pause and see if that kind of...
Yeah, no, that's... So I love this. And so as I'm hearing you talk, Savi, I got a question here. Let me kind of paraphrase. It really speaks to how aligned and in communication organizations need to be. And, you know, as much as we all have collaboration tools coming out of our ears these days, we know that can be a challenge. You know, the, you know, what you're saying really speaks to the importance of, you know, the market facing functions of a company, like innovation, like strategy, competitive intelligence, marketing, you know, et cetera, that they need to be aligned. And so maybe a couple moments and take your thoughts on culture, where this notion of, you know, running a business where the growth functions are on the same page. I mean, that takes a lot of cultural, you know, trust, but then also where you can have the ambidexterity of your core, probably slower growth, lower margin, but reliable cash cow businesses. And then the higher growth, volatile, you know, fail forward, more venture businesses. That's asking a lot of a culture. So how does Nike balance that tension between two very different mindsets?
Yeah, that's it's a constant thing. But I think the first thing is to acknowledge, you're right. Like when I speak to category, you know, as a weekly basis, we have category alignments and they say, I have a P&L and I'm bringing in this much money and you're telling me you have more budget than I do? And I'm like, absolutely, yeah. Right? And so, you know.
Good for you.
Exactly, that's the reality. But then, you know, we are talking, this is, you know, like categories that revenue generating and the R&D unit or the incubator where there is free flow of money, but then the technology and operations, which is again, you know, the process heavy, high process, low budget, stringent. So the the first thing is to really acknowledge. I think being able to, you know, particularly at the leadership level, there should be a clear acknowledgement that there is going to be different cultures. So how do we hire and nurture for those cultures? But then also, how do we cross-pollinate if there is interest? So let me expand on that a little bit. So I experienced both. So I was in entrepreneurial, then I was in cost-saving functions. It's like I had a roller coaster of, you know, going through these. And even within cost-saving functions, when you have a large program that is spending like in upwards of $30 million, that feels like a little bit like, you know, like an incubator, because, you know, you're implementing this big process reengineering, technology, operations, operating model, and so forth. But then, you know, when you are in the more in the support mode, it feels very constrained. So both, you know, so the typically what we have seen is the, you know, sometimes this low morale or high burnout or feeling like I'm kind of stuck is one of the things that you see from an employee standpoint. On the other side, in the fast-paced, you know, incubators, that's no easy hike. You have, again, long hours, you have a lot of burnout, but then you also, you know, have this adrenaline, you know, when something works. It, you know, when you get something out and the consumer response is good, or when you get something out and, you know, there's a market is actually positively taking it, it's there is the big reward. And then fail forward culture is something to inculcate, instill there and inculcate, because without that, that extra hours that you work without necessarily extra pay, feel like, why am I doing it? You know, if I fail, that means am I a loser? So I think, you know, that is, that's like the picture and the nature of these two functions. Now, one of the key things that that is important is how do you hire and nurture? And this is where I think you need distinctly different set of talent, right? The first one requires creative leadership, motivational people that are that can thrive in ambiguity, you know, and leaders that can, and managers where the funding is flowing rather easily, you need disciplined risk taking. You cannot put your bets on everything, right? And then, you know, you have to have those people that believe in the cause and that are going to go after for the 30, 60, 90 days and knowing that it can fail, like being able to take failure. That's like one of the. And then on the other side, this is like make things work, you know. This is where you need solid subject matter experts, like the deep expertise in the subject, you know, being able to be okay with the processes, being able to be okay with this rigidity of, you know, the gates, rigidity of the gates and how you need to operate. And so you need a different level of management and leadership there. And I think that is an important, like, you know, hiring and nurturing for the two different talents. Then the next thing that I have seen is very important is emphasizing the value that each of those functions bring. And that is so important. And you need to emphasize to each other. And I have seen when, you know, I was in the cost savings business versus, you know, business unit working in there, or I was in the innovation research, like we, the leaders specifically talk about, and I have done my share too, because when people say, oh, I have to work with tech and they have these processes and they want me to log this stuff I don't like, then you kind of work with them on why it is important to have those stringency there. So emphasize the value and if possible, monetize the value. And we weren't doing that up until 2016, but we started monetizing, like, you know, tech started monetizing, tech and ops. Categories, of course, they have their P&L, but then, you know, innovation functions started monetizing the supportive functions of the innovations. So when you monetize, people feel that, oh, I contributed to this, you know, whatever, $25 million this particular product produced because I was the AI engineer on that. I think, you know, that's another aspect. Then for tech and ops function alone, we have done something that was that really worked. One was that function, tech and ops typically felt like, you know, they only have incremental innovations. They never are part of something that's groundbreaking, that's trailblazing. So we created something like, okay, you know, you say that if I had 3 hours in a week, I would do this thing, I would change this, or I would, you know, innovate here, that's not just incremental. So we opened up something called Summer Innovation Fridays. In summer, Friday afternoon, you have 4 hours. You don't need to work on what it is on your, you know, like the part of your daily, weekly work, like your role. Pick something. If you are fascinated by something, form a team, work on something. And this was started in 2014-ish. It has been immense success. Then when we saw the first year, it's been successful, 2015. And in the second part, I had my handies, we created something called a platform for crowdsourcing. So where, you know, a function, logistics says, I want to run a hackathon to improve the pace of, you know, packaging products, right? And so, you know, that's something, there is something in the DC that they have a need for. And so they say the goals of that particular hackathon, and then people start putting in the individual problems they want to solve, the business owners within that logistics. But then it's open to the whole company. So anybody in any function can go and assign themselves to be part of the team, they self-form, and then they have 2.5 days where they work on and come up with a solution. And that was an immense success, crowdsourcing within the company. And so that started shifting a little bit. You know, it doesn't shift entirely, but it shows that, hey, yes, you are in the process CV function, but you have avenues where you can show your creativity and then make connections. And if you want to move, you can move. And then lastly, the AI and ML, you know, the advent of those and they becoming integral part of anything you deliver, it is changing the face of, you know, the process heavy function slowly. Because if AI and ML really take over automation, tech and ops at some point will become profit centers, not more cost centers anymore, because AI automated, so you got it.
It's a huge change.
You know, do you see what I'm saying?
I know, totally. And that's a... It's a perfect segue. So it's like we planned this. Talking about digital transformation, you know, at the macro levels, also, you know, some of the, you know, smaller aspects of it, like AI, ML, et cetera. I'd love your perspective on that, because you mentioned this phrase a moment ago, disciplined risk taking. And, you know, now I think, you know, most people will get that digital transformation is a reality and an enormous opportunity, but, you know, especially when you're dipping the toe in the water a few years ago with health analytics, I mean, that's a big risk. And so, you know, what role has digital transformation, both from how Nike operates, but also how it creates value, what role has digital transformation played in the strategy and the strategy process?
Right. That's digital transformation at Nike. I think Nike did a little bit of a catch up and a little bit of hurry up offense. And that has been a great learning opportunity. So when, you know, retail was being owned and we wanted to grow digital retail back in the 2009-10, that period, you know, we didn't focus to do the digital landscape modernization of the Nike's technology and process reengineering landscape as quickly as we should have done. But that's, you know, we caught up. But so they tried to beef up that infrastructure. But it was only as we got into more like 2013s and 14s is when they realized that, you know, we need to have some fundamental infrastructure changes in terms of, you know, leveraging more of that hybrid clouds or having, you know, from an e-commerce platform, having some of these tools that are some of the processes automated and some of these analytical tools, you know, that do the sentiment analysis, that do the search analytics, that do, you know, so because all of those have valuable information that goes on a daily basis for the operations management, but that also aggregated level goes into the strategy formulation, because there is, once you aggregate, there is this super amount, you know, wonderful intelligence coming out of that. You know, you can see those thematic trends. Same with the health analytics. We saw that industry is picking up, but for, you know, again, we started a little bit slower, but then as we got into 2019, we started picking up in terms of, you know, leveraging the power of data science, the power of, you know, machine learning algorithms. And there is the data is collected, like amassed, right? When you think about Nike, we're not talking just the orders fulfilled and all of that. Who is buying what? Not just even that, but what the consumer dialogue that's happening in the various social forums. The social media is suddenly a huge, you know, source of a lot of information, right? So that is where, that's one aspect. Then the Nike has these membership programs. Many of you may have seen and heard or used is Nike Running Club app, Nike Training Club app. So these are Nike Plus membership. So these, you know, when you think about the training club and running club, it is basically telling, you know, what I do on a daily, weekly basis and when I didn't do and what I did and so on and so forth. So that is the data that has been accumulated, but it is only towards 2018, 19, we actually started like wow, there is this wealth that we can slice and dice and analyze and, you know, create some models and train them and then run them to see what is coming out as exploratory trends, what are coming out as potentially predictive, or, you know, are there prescriptive things we can do based on what we are seeing here? So it has started slowly, but then it has, you know, beefed up, and then we are, so it's almost like we are fueling the plane when it is right at 33,000. So, you know, we are continuing to run the business, very profitable growth, but we are also beefing up the infrastructure and getting the right tools and technologies to do that.
Yeah, and that's great. We got a question on that. And this, if this is too in the weeds, let me know. Understanding, you know, that there's not a large central competitive intelligence group at Nike, and you mentioned a lot of the, you know, the monitoring, both formal and informal, of the external environment is done, you know, by strategy and a lot of the consumer facing groups. What kind of skills do those types of people have when it comes to AI and ML? You know, so that, you know, both from a, you know, how you create value, but also just some of the tools that you use, you know, what's the skill level there, if you could generalize in those roles at Nike?
Oh, the intelligence group itself from an AI and ML standpoint, I think, you know, so from the, I have met a variety of them throughout my 20 years and, you know, that the global corporate strategy group, I think their skill set has been evolving too. So, you know, traditionally back in 2007 and 8, when I started interacting with them, these were the hardcore strategy major, you know, MBAs from, you know, wonderful colleges that we have in the United States, exactly. And that are really focused on the macro picture. And then they are partnering with the people like me who were kind of in the business and looking at things. Now, as we went through, I think the skill set has gone from just being the, you know, it's not nothing wrong in being a solid strategist, but somebody who has also has that background in the information sciences a little bit. It doesn't have to be a major, but I have seen people to be, you know, being very comfortable and actually understanding what role robotic process automation is playing because they have had either a course or they have done a course and they have dabbled in it, and to, you know, have the deep analytical skills in terms of, you know, if they have some gathered a lot of data, and also the business modeling skills, right? You know, because when you have the information, you know, how do you do the scenario modeling and so forth? So they, you are seeing a lot of both the expertise and experiences in these fields. And at the same time, they also, for instance, you know, we pull in the people from the functions, right? There's a collaboration, that is the best part of it. And you actually have people that is like the chief data scientist of that particular organization right there. So I think that combination is what is helping.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And that's definitely reflective, and I think, in what we see at, you know, certainly not all the Skip members, but several of them, where, you know, even if you're not a data scientist, you know, there's a certain level of knowledge and familiarity, if not fluency, increasingly you just need to have, even if for no other reason than to say, this might be a, you know, problem that, you know, AI could help me solve, or, you know, that I could apply a tool to this or automate this in some way. So that there's that awareness. And maybe from the consumer perspective, I guess, you know, as consumers become more digitally savvy and probably demanding, I think that's fair to say, how has that shifted Nike's strategy?
Yeah, that I think, you know, the consumer evolution in the digital savviness has been a huge, you know, it's almost like one of our strong signals. I think, you know, there is not one strong signal, but this is one of the very strong signals. And I think the first area where we started experiencing that was again in these Nike Run Club or Nike Training Club apps that Nike has. You know, for those who may not have used this app, these apps actually, Nike Run Club, you know, cheers you up and tells you how wonderful that you have done this particular set of runs or walks during this week and how you're doing better every week and so forth. So there is a elite athlete or a professional athlete that comes and talks to you during a little bit, cheering you up, like being the cheerleader, and towards the end. Training Club has a series of programs that help you train for your just health and wellness. You know, and they had a different levels of complexity. Like, you know, if I want to have an easy one or if somebody is starting, right? So that's kind of the context on them. And that is where we experienced the savviness. And this is where consumers, for example, started asking just as like, you know, starting like 2018, 2019, you know, like, can you tell me what I wear depending on where I live and my weather? They're like, whoa, you know, because like, you know, that's like, they're always on the phone, right? Yeah. Or can you tell me if I need to take a break, right? Or can you tell me if I'm doing, you know, so when we started hearing those, one of the things that I have seen, you know, on this human data analytics side, like in the groups that I have been part of, and I have the data scientists that I have, one of the things we started doing was that, okay, they're asking, there is a trend here. The consumer is saying, you know, hey, I am really a digital person. So how can you be part of my life on this dimension of my life? So we took this billions and trillions of records we have in the Nike Run Club, you know, the recorded runs. And we started seeing, you know, for example, this is where our data scientists have done really deep analysis. And they wanted to look at things like, hey, you know, has the performance been dropping for some people who have been doing every day, runs every day? And when they don't do run every day, have they had a better performance, right? So they started looking for things that you don't normally think about because of these questions that people are asking.
Exactly.
We also run a small thing where, you know, we started asking people what they're wearing, you know, just as an exploratory thing. And then lo and behold, then, you know, they come back and say that, you know, I really wonder if Nike can, you know, help me. So they are going from telling them to how to, you know, what to do as part of their training to even saying, what do I wear from a Nike apparel standpoint, right? You know, or can you tell me, for instance, when I need to buy a new pair of Nike shoes, because you know that I bought a new pair of Nike shoes because I tagged them as the shoes I'm wearing. Like, so that is where, you know, consumer really wants us to be part of their life. And that's where, you know, we are seeing that, okay, there is a large opportunity here to be able to continue this conversation and the richness of the dialogue.
Yeah. Now, just being mindful of time, you know, I have, you know, one more question on my end prepared, Savvy, and then, you know, anyone else feel free to, you know, drop in the chat as you have been with questions. One of the things that I think is really powerful about our conversation today is what you've shared about really, you know, Nike taking a long-term view of all this, where, you know, for example, you talked about, you know, very social trends where it wasn't just, hey, we promote this good social issue just because we want to sell you more stuff. I mean, so it was very much done in an authentic way. And so kind of with that, you know, what's the balance between, you know, like kind of almost creating like a virtuous cycle between competition, strategy, market share, where it's not just, you know, being, you know, brute force and cutthroat at any moment. How do you really view this from a sustainable, long-term virtuous cycle approach?
Yeah, what I have seen and what I have heard from, you know, leadership talking, and then of course, you know, being in that the leadership pipeline that I have continued to talk about, is anytime, you know, when there is a question about should we do this or not from a strategic standpoint, go back to who are we serving? I think that's kind of where Nike takes you back. Who are we serving? And so, consumer centricity is like one of the mantras. And Nike calls the consumers, as in a fitting language for somebody like Nike, as athletes. So we call everybody as an athlete. If you have heard, Bill Bowerman, our co-founder, said, if you have a body, you are an athlete. And we really take it into all of our strategy decks and competition analysis. So, you know, we talk about, okay, listen to the voice of the athlete is a big sign in our innovation buildings and in every building, right? So, you know, so that kind of keeps you grounded. So there is not a second question. So whether you are in the competitive intelligence, you know, that global strategy group, or in the regular strategy, or you are the, you know, program manager or developer, you know, you're anchored into that one. And that is, you know, because then what you're doing is, as you're formulating strategy, or when you are looking at the competitors, you're listening to the consumer, then you're also listening to the consumer, you're seeing some themes, then you go and do the market and industry analysis. So then, you know, because it essentially becomes like a nice virtuous cycle, because what you're putting into strategy, and then as you execute strategy, you're gathering that feedback, and both thematically and market level, and bringing it back. So that is, you know, one of the ways of, you know, keeping it strong in terms of how do we What we create is what the consumer needs. And in the process, we are really going to be part of the consumer's overall life experience as opposed to a transactional relationship.
That is fantastic. Yeah, it's just kind of reflecting on this, and it's really, no organization is perfect, right? And so I think, you've done a great job describing, some of Nike's really incredible, capabilities. But I think for me, the most powerful takeaway is that, customer first mentality, whether you're mm-hmm. B2C or B2B, it probably doesn't matter, right? But, that you're really, grounding your strategy and then the way you make strategic choices in the customer experience, in what drives that. And it's not just what's right in front of you, but looking, as you say, kind of along the R&D and more immediate needs, as well as, farther out needs through incubators and probably even some venture funding as well. Has there ever been, you got a question here, this might be a little bit of a curveball for our last one. Has there ever been a time where, the intelligence or information you had about a market or an opportunity let you down, either in other words, that you knew something was there, the intelligence didn't back it up and you went after it, or where, the intelligence said that this is not a good opportunity, but you ignored it and it turned out to be good. It's at what point sometimes do you go with your gut instead of data?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting one. And, this is, you probably have seen it, observed it in the media over the last few years. So there was this thing about influencers, and we saw some of our competitors going to, a different influencers from different professions. So, you have the musicians and you have, a variety, some of our competitors went and, got them as influencers of their brand. And there was a time where this was actually a conversation, so how does Nike choose its influencers? And that's, so should we, when we see our competitors doing that, do we follow suit or do we, what do we do? And yes, there was a period where I think, some of those influencer relationships of our competitors seemed like they are, the consumers were responding very positively to that. So there was an internal conversation about, hey, maybe we should do the same thing or we should, and this is where I think Nike also, the overarching Nike leadership, say there's, as I was telling you, there is a strategy units and our strategists, as part of the various functions, but then also the CEO and the CEO's staff, they are very active and involved when they need to. So our president of innovation actually is very, very, he can get into the details if possible, if needed. And this is where I think, when we had this conversation and thought that we should, there is a section of people who are thinking, I think Nike, the president of innovation again, just brought us back and grounded saying that, hey, we have our strategy. I know it seems like that is a great opportunity and we feel like maybe we should have done that too, but what else could we do staying course on our strategic direction, mm-hmm. right? Yes, it seems like it, but so there is that does happen. And so yes, there is a time period when there is disgruntled people. I thought we should do it too. Yep, but then somehow we get grounded back and we continue with what we had as a long-term vision and it worked out.
Yeah. And it's a great kind of, place to end because it's a reminder that, data and analytics and AI and ML and all that stuff, which is incredibly powerful, that it's a tool. It's not that we're always going to get the answer from it. And so human judgment and gut feeling plays a role. But in the context of, making decisions based on the best information that you have.
Yeah.
Savi, we are out of time, but I really want to thank you so much for being so generous with us today. Thanks to all for joining. Got lots of good questions and we really just appreciate you sharing your great experiences and perspectives with us, Savi. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. This has been a wonderful set of questions, Cam, and also the questions that came from audience. It's very insightful and very good discussion in terms of, the interactivity. So I really appreciate it. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Fantastic. Folks, we will share the recording and, feel free to connect with Savi on LinkedIn. She's a rock star and keep safe. And we will see all the Skip members again soon. Thanks, Savi.
Yeah, thank you all again. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Michelle.